Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, is the Bush administration using the so-called war on terror to destroy dissent in the United States? Are we seeing the rise of the old Nixon strategy? When they went after Daniel Ellsberg, when they broke into his psychiatrist's office, only now instead of having illegal break-ins, are they having the Department of Homeland Security do it legally? And if Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist, say, back in the old days, right? Back in the day, when Nixon wanted to break into Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist, he had to hire some criminals to do it. And they did a break-in because it was against the law. Well, now, with the Patriot Act, recently passed, well, or it's through the Senate, now with the Patriot Act, all they'd have to do is the FBI would sign a national security letter, 15,000 of them last year, apparently, and they'd go to a psychiatrist and say, give us everything you got on Daniel Ellsberg. We're not going to break in. You're just going to give it to us. And if you don't give it to us, you go to jail. And by the way, if you tell Daniel Ellsberg that we're here snooping on him, you go to jail too. I mean, consider the difference from the early 1970s, when Nixon was doing that to cover up his essentially crimes in Vietnam, because it was all about the Pentagon Papers being published, the Pentagon Papers being the internal analysis that the Pentagon had done that showed that essentially the war in Vietnam was unwinnable. And now you've got a war, we have a war in Iraq that is essentially unwinnable because we don't have a specific enemy. We already won the war. We already beat Saddam Hussein. I mean, when are Americans going to figure this out? That when Bush said hostilities are over.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
When he said that, he was right. We actually did win the war. It's, you know, it only took a couple of weeks. Now we've got this occupation. That's not a war. An occupation is not a war. It's an occupation. And the occupied people are saying, we would rather you are not here. They're saying it to the Zogby poll. They're saying it to our soldiers, tragically, with IEDs and bullets. They're saying it to the world, and they're saying it to each other. Just like they were in Vietnam. They fought off the French. They fought off the Americans. No country wants to be occupied. So during the Vietnam War, you had Nixon going after anybody who was going to talk about what was really going on. And now during the Bush administration, are they using this so-called war on terror? And I say so-called because there is no terror there that you can point to. You can't say, okay, the enemy is Ralph in Frankfurt, Germany, on the corner of Karl Wilhelm Strasse and Main Street. You can't say that it's the government of Patagonia. There's not a specific enemy here. You can't have a war on a strategy. I mean, you know, you can work to stop it. You can fight against it, but that's not what Congress, you know, when Congress declares a war, it's against a country. Or you can declare an organization criminal and you can bring the world together against them. But in any case, is the Bush administration using their so-called war on terror to destroy dissent? Yesterday, Doug Thompson over at Capitol Hill Blue published a rant in which he talked about how George W. Bush had launched a war against reporters. And by the way, you know, Thompson's not the only one saying this. The New York Times was pointing it out. A war against reporters, preparing to prosecute, investigate and prosecute reporters for under a pre-World War I law for receiving classified information. In other words, if a whistleblower tells a reporter something that the Bush administration has decided is classified. And they are deciding things. They're going back to the 1940s and deciding that things are classified. And certainly anything that the Bush administration has done that might fall into the category of a high crime or misdemeanor, you can bet your bottom dollar is classified. So Doug Thompson over at Capitol Hill Blue, he runs his own server. Most people don't run their own servers. Most people go to a company that runs servers, and they say, you know, I'll pay you a certain number of dollars every month if you'll let me have my website on your place. Right? You go to Earthlink or Mindspring or AOA. I don't know who they all are, but and there's local ones all over the place. But Doug actually owned his own server. So he was his own internet service provider, or his own web hosting provider, rather. And so apparently, if Doug's editorial of yesterday is to be believed, the FBI showed up and they said, we want to know everything about this nasty guy, Doug Thompson. We have this national security letter, 15,000 of these things they issued last year. We want to know, you know, everything. And they can look into your doctor records, into your bank records, or, you know, what you bought, where you went, where you were, how much your rent is, who you're visiting with, who you've called on the telephone and when you called them. All this, you know, all this kind of stuff. They can sweep it all together. And they said, by the way, if you tell this Doug Thompson guy that we are asking you for this information, you've committed a crime. This is the thing that the librarians are so upset about. That if they come looking for your library records, they can't tell you that they're looking for your library records. And what they didn't realize, apparently, was that Doug Thompson himself was the guy that they were talking to. They're saying, you know, and so he was in the situation where he couldn't tell himself that he knew that he was being investigated because that would be a crime. And he wrote about it. Well, today, he had to change the story. And you will find the new story over at CapitolHillBlue.com. Doug Thompson writes, on an unspecified day last week, an employee of a federal agency that cannot be revealed delivered a document that cannot be identified to a company that cannot be named, seeking information that cannot be discussed. Is this starting to sound to you like something out of Kafka's The Prisoner? And by the way, if you've never read The Prisoner, it's a short story by Franz Kafka. Go out, get it, and read it. It's probably online someplace. He goes on to say, the aforementioned federal agent left the unidentified document with an employee of the unnamed company. The employee then called the owner, who must remain anonymous, to inform him that the document that could not be identified sought information that could not be discussed. The owner, who must remain anonymous, instructed the employee to deliver the unidentified document to a lawyer whose name is protected by attorney-client privilege. The lawyer, whose name is protected by attorney-client privilege, examined the unidentified document and then reviewed the information that could not be discussed with the owner, who must remain anonymous. With the approval of the owner, who must remain anonymous, the lawyer, whose name is protected by attorney-client privilege, contacted a U.S. attorney who demanded that his identity be concealed. The U.S. attorney who demanded that his identity be concealed then claimed the owner, who must remain anonymous. Now, I think we can assume that that would be Doug Thompson. Violated the law that cannot be disclosed and faced arrest for charges that cannot be specified because he had referred to the document that cannot be identified in an article for a certain but unnamed website. The lawyer, whose name is protected by attorney-client privilege, argued that his client cannot be charged under the undisclosed law because he had been acting as a journalist at the time of the alleged publication and not as the owner of the company that cannot be named. He had, in fact, learned of the existence of the document that cannot be identified from a third party who was not named and was not aware of its exact contents because he had not seen or read the document and therefore was not aware of the exact contents that cannot be discussed. The U.S. attorney who demanded his identity be concealed consulted with others whose names are classified and concluded that the owner, who must remain anonymous, walked a fine line between legal and illegal, and would not face arrest for violating a law that cannot be disclosed on charges that could not be specified. So walking this fine line of justice allowed the owner, who must remain anonymous, to avoid confinement at an institution at an unknown location for an unspecified length of time. Now here's the kicker. In exchange for his freedom, writes Doug Thompson today on Capitol Hill Blue, presumably referring to himself, who knows, in exchange for his freedom, the owner, who must remain anonymous, agreed to write a clarification, in quotes, of what happened, following the guidelines for publication laid down by the Bush administration, which is what you just read. That's the story. Is the Bush administration using their so-called war on terror to destroy dissent, to go after the press? Here you have Doug Thompson, Capitol Hill Blue, the press, being told that he can't even discuss the law under which he's being investigated without being sent to a prison which can't be disclosed. And he's being told this by a U.S. attorney whose name can't be... I mean, have we become the Soviet Union? Two capitalisms stop in a snowy road. One took the path less traveled by, and that made all the difference. Joyce Marcel over at CommonDreams.org. More on that right after this. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman. So many lonely people, damn the stroke of tears. Yes, I know it could be better to say that about anything.
And welcome back, my friends. Helping you with the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. Joyce Marcel writes on CommonDreams.org about two capitalisms. She's talking about how China is taking the capitalism plus communism road, whereas Russia is taking the capitalism plus oligarchy road. And so, she suggests, is the United States. And what happened to democracy? This is one of the great myths. One of the great myths that is promulgated by the right in the United States, and that is that capitalism and democracy are somehow the same thing. Capitalism is an economic system, pure and simple. Democracy is a political system. Democracy is ruled by we the people, and democracy in a constitutionally limited representative republic is where we the people elect representatives who operate within a very clearly defined constraint of laws, constitutional laws that protect the rights of minorities and assert the will of the majority to the extent that it doesn't infringe on the rights of the minorities. And we have this thing that we've had in the United States for going, 230 some odd years now of a fundamental social contract that we're all in this together. And that social contract started breaking down when Ronald Reagan came into office. And, telling his cute little joke about, the scariest words in the human language, in the English language are, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. and waging war on government. And I really don't think that Ronald Reagan ever understood that when he was waging war on government, when he was using that demagogic language to suggest that government is the evil, that really what he was doing was he was waging war on democracy. And the fruit of that is that big special interests. You got Randy Duke Cunningham being dragged off to jail for taking bribes. What about the company that bribed him? Or companies? I mean, what happened there? Turns out that one of them apparently has been giving Catherine Harris money. Remember her from Florida? So you have a situation now where the wealthy and the powerful, they're doing just fine. Thank you very much. And anybody who speaks out, anybody who speaks up, the instrument of government is used against them. Now, let us keep in mind, there are two dimensions of government. I mean, this is really vital to understand. Conservatives and libertarians for years and years and years, and for that matter, liberals, Franklin Roosevelt used to talk about this as well, have suggested, and way back, I mean, all the way back to Jefferson, have understood that there are really two dimensions to government. And one is that government is organized violence. It is legalized organized violence. And I don't mean that in a negative way. Government is the only institution in our society that we give the right to kill people to. A police officer can shoot somebody. An army The job of an army is to kill people. In the United States, in some states, the state can put people to death. Now, that's not something that we've allowed any corporation to do. That's not something we allow individuals to do. Only the government has that power. And in a democracy, the government has that power, and it's very, very limited. This was the fear of the founders, that power of organized violence, which is represented by government, might get out of control, that it needed to be limited, thus the Bill of Rights, among other things. So on the one hand, you have the power of organized violence that is government. And on the other hand, you have the social contract that is government. That we, the people, collectively, in addition to protecting ourselves with organized violence, because the idea of organized violence in government is to protect society from those who would endanger it without, that is, armies, and within, that is, police. Okay, so, and both are considered a social good. That on the one hand, we're protecting our society from those who would harm us, and on the other hand, we are protecting society from the dangers associated with everyday life. That is to say, for example, a child born with birth defects, or a family who's lost their job, or somebody who has fallen and broken their neck and they're paralyzed. How do we deal with the least among us? As Joyce Marcel writes, a friend of hers was visiting from China, from Shanghai, and said, talking about the poverty in Vermont, and said, how's your government planning to fix this? And she says, I suddenly realized we no longer have a government interested in fixing things. Our government is not interested in supporting a medical system that works for all Americans. Instead, it's interested in supporting a healthy health insurance industry. Not interested in protecting our infrastructure. No vast budget for fixing roads, bridges, airports, mass transit. Not interested in improving security. Not interested in protecting the natural world in which we live. All of this is denied in the name of corporate profits. Not interested in protecting our freedoms. That patriots throughout the years, throughout the centuries, have fought and died for here in the United States. Not interested in protecting the economic wealth and well-being of America and its people. Not interested in protecting us even from our enemies. This is how far we have gone down that road that Reagan started us, and Bush is the logical conclusion, where the war on terror is being used against journalists in America. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Lord have mercy on the blue collar man. Oh, Lord have mercy on the blue collar man.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we run rings around the right wing every day, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And even replayed on the weekends. Welcome back to our program. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Our live chat room at tomhartman.com. It's T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's, but however you spell it will get you there. And just click the live chat link. As I was saying, this all really began with the war on democracy. The war on the idea that we the people could get together and say, you know, there are some things that we're going to do for ourselves. We're going to care for the least fortunate among us. We're going to save capitalism from itself. We're going to save ourselves from the predators among us. And we're going to do this by collectively banding together and forming an instrument, a device, a social contract, a mechanism that we call government. And that government is going to be of, by, and for not the wealthy, not the corporate powers, not the fascists, not the communists, not the French, not the British, not the Dubaiis. It's going to be of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. And the war on that idea of civil governance began in 1981.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And thus it began. The taking apart of the government of the United States. And so the people down in New Orleans, hey, don't you know? Those are terrifying words. Government might help you. The people whose lives were shattered by 9/11, oh, don't you know? It's a terrifying thing. Government might help you. 45 million Americans who have no health insurance. Oh, don't you know? It's a terrifying thing. The government, that we might help ourselves. It is, after all, the highest of the historic, both Jewish and Christian, and for that matter, Muslim and Hindu and Buddhist traditions. Whether you're talking about Tikkun or whether you're talking about Matthew 25 or the Sermon on the Mount, the idea that we care for those among us. There's a study that I quoted in my book, What Would Jefferson Do?, that was first reported on by the British Broadcasting Company back about 4 years ago, where they found that every year that a conservative government came into power in England, whenever conservative governments came into power in the United Kingdom, suicide rates went up. Middle-class suicide rates went up. And every year liberal governments came into power in England, suicide rates went down. And in fact, they calculated, as I recall, the exact numbers in my book, and I don't have it in front of me, but my recollection was that it was something like on the order of about 10,000 suicides a year that you could trace directly to there being a conservative government. Now, USA Today yesterday had an interesting little graphic, and I when I saw this, it reminded me of a study that I read 20 years ago, and Louise and I spent at least an hour this morning trying to find this thing on the internet. And apparently, I mean, this was from the 70s, so apparently, you know, nobody has bothered. This was before there was an internet. Nobody has bothered to put it on. But I remember it very well. I remember when it came out. I remember using it in a speech that I gave many times over a period of years during the 1970s. And it was a study on happiness. And it really related to Abraham Maslow's idea of a hierarchy of human needs, what sometimes people refer to as Maslow's hierarchy or Maslow's pyramid, that at the bottom there's the need for safety and security and the need for you know, the essentials of life, food, clothing, shelter. And people will do pretty much anything to get those needs met. And then once those needs are met, then there's the middle needs, the social needs, the need for family and friends and relationships. And then once those needs are met, then you go to the highest needs, the needs for the transcendent needs, the needs for the spiritual, the need to fall in love, the need for self-actualization, what Maslow called. But that most people who know that those fundamental needs for safety and security will always be satisfied, describe themselves as, at their core, fundamentally happy. They're striving for things, but at their core, they're fundamentally happy. And the study that was done back in the 70s that I was unable to find showed that the American middle class, by and large, mostly described themselves as happy, and that if you went from what was in the 70s, then $30,000, $40,000 a year income, what would today be $50,000, $60,000, which is actually above the middle class. The median income in the United States is $43,000, as I recall. But in any case, just, you know, generally kind of a middle class income. But if you went from that to $1 million a year, $5 million a year, $20 million a year, there really wasn't that much of a difference in how people described themselves as being happy or not happy back in the 70s. And the reason why, I would suggest to you, was because back in the 70s, there was an intact social safety net. People had good jobs. They had pensions. They had health insurance. They knew that, you know, they weren't just one illness away from disaster and literally living on the streets. They knew that there were lots of good jobs to be had, good union jobs or the equivalent out there. We were manufacturing things in this country. We were a wealthy nation. We weren't in debt to the rest of the world. Our government was being run by rational people. And people knew that they weren't just one, you know, the loss of a job away from disaster. But now we find this study in USA Today from yesterday, Money and Happiness, that people who earn less than $34,000 a year, only 24% of them describe themselves as very happy. $30,000 to $75,000 a year, only 33%. $75,000 to $99,000, 38%. $100,000 or more, 49%. And I would suggest to you that the reason why we're seeing this stratification is that we are all now the poor. At least all of us who earn less than a few hundred thousand dollars or a few million dollars, frankly, a year. I mean, how much does it take to deal with a serious loss like getting cancer and losing your job as a result of it? And having to provide for years of medical treatment and years of your life in a perhaps disabled situation. It could take millions of dollars, given the way that our healthcare system and our Social Security system works in the United States. And I don't mean Social Security with a capital S, but our social safety net. And so those people who have millions of dollars in the bank have some level of safety and security, going back to Maslow's hierarchy. Everybody else, people making $30,000, making $50,000, making $80,000, making $100,000, making $200,000 a year, they think they're doing okay, but they all know. We all know in the American middle class that we're just one or two or three paychecks away, just one job loss away, just one serious illness away from disaster in this country. As a result of this philosophy,
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And as a result, we're seeing since Reagan was elected that the American middle class is evaporating. And I've got all the details on this financially. I don't need to go through all the numbers. It could, just become a boring rant, but we sense it. We sense it. Glenn in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Glenn, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Glenn?
Well, you were talking about the social contract before. And if you look all the way back in the Republic, Socrates is talking about in the story of the Apology how he'd be put to death for the social contract that he has to abide by because he was born a citizen.
Right.
And I mean, and this is
that. Although you have to, if you're a student of Plato, you know that Plato and Socrates also did not trust democracy.
Well, no, I would say the Republic is one of the foundations for a fascist state. But
right, I would agree with you.
I think it's pretty interesting that it goes back that far.
Yeah, and there's a fascinating book called The Trial of Socrates about how, basically Socrates facilitated the overthrow of the 30 and the overthrow of the 300 or the 40 and the 400, whatever it was, the two coups, basically, that overthrew Athenian democracy. And that's why he was never prosecuted, and that's why ultimately they made him commit suicide. For what was technically, they defined it as the corruption of the youth, but really it was that he was preaching that democracy was a bad thing. But
well,
but Plato did raise the issue of the social contract. You're right.
Yeah, I know that Hitler, that was one of his favorite books. He kept a copy of the Republic by his bedside.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Plato has been used and misused by so many folks. Glenn, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Thanks for the call, and thanks for making the point. I mean, this is the thing. Jefferson and Madison used to have discussions about, you go back and you read the letters between Jefferson and Madison, and they would have these debates. I mean, Jefferson and Adams, because John Adams thought that Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, he thought that they were all right. They were correct, that democracy really isn't the natural state of things. And Jefferson was convinced that democracy was the natural state of things. He said, I will trust the people, not the rich. And John Adams, on the other hand, the second president of the United States, was saying, no. You got to have an aristocracy. You call it democracy. You make it look like a democracy, but you've got to have an aristocracy. And that's the philosophy that Ronald Reagan brought into office and that has prevailed in this country ever since. We're looking at oligarchy emerging in the United States, ruling families, dynasties. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman here on the place where smart people get their news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You're gonna break.
break another heart, you're gonna tell another lie.
Ah, yes, George. We know it's coming. Welcome back, my friend. Male full-time workers in 2003 earned $800 less than their counterparts in 1970 after adjusting for inflation. And not only that, transportation costs are up, childcare costs are up, mortgage costs are up, health care costs are up. Divorced women with children, divorced men with child support are three times as likely to file for bankruptcy as married counterparts. The modern single-earner family trying to keep up an average lifestyle faces a 72% drop in discretionary income compared with its one income counterpart a generation ago. In just one generation, this is just since Reagan. He has taken our country apart, and now they're selling it off piece by piece so that the oligarchy can emerge. In the next hour, I want to share with you what our founders thought about this kind of thing and what they did about it. We haven't the time for that right now. Alex in Aberdeen, Maryland. Hey, Alex, welcome to the program.
Hey, I did want to comment that lobbyists and campaign contributions have turned this country into an oligarchy. It's not really a democracy anymore because, you know, apparently the people don't really have a voice anymore. You know, as far as voting or anything like that. It's all about who can.
And we should define, Alex, for our listeners, the word oligarchy, because probably a lot of people don't know what that means. It's not, you know, something I doubt that they're teaching in school anymore. An oligarchy basically is a government that is run by a small number of families or dynasties. And I haven't looked in a dictionary in 30 or 40 years on the word, so I may be technically, you know, there may be some more sophisticated definition of it, but that's my understanding of it. I'm assuming that that's yours.
Right. Yes, it's a small number of wealthy individuals.
Right, like the 36 families who run Mexico, basically. You know, there's like, you know, 15 families, I believe it is, who run Colombia. You know, most South American countries, there's a handful of families that basically own 80, 90% of all the wealth in the country. And we are now an oligarchy in the United States, and it's growing. And in fact, you look at, I mean, here's Bill Clinton. Here's a guy who was born dirt poor and clawed his way to the top. And I look back on this and I say, you know, what was the turning point? When did he become part of the oligarchy? And I could just imagine somebody sitting him down and saying, and they don't even in fact have to sit you down and say it. You just have dinner with the right people, you know, kind of thing,
right.
Like you're talking about over on the Think Progress blog today. But basically the message he got was, if you give America over to the multinational corporations, surrender our sovereignty, give up our laws, and allow multinational corporations to have more power than our elected legislatures and our Congress, by signing GATT and creating the World Trade Organization and signing NAFTA, then we'll bring you into the club, and you will become a multimillionaire, perhaps even a billionaire. Your wife can run for president. The Clinton dynasty will begin, just like the Bush dynasty did back with Prescott helping support Hitler during World War II, you know, lining up with the Republicans against Roosevelt. And and I know that sounds rather harsh of Bill Clinton, but I can come up with no other reason why he possibly could have done that, and his behavior since then seems to reinforce it in my mind. In any case, the oligarchs are now running this country, and what that means is the death of the middle class, because you can't have an oligarchy and a strong middle class at the same time, because the middle class will fight back.
Yeah, and as far as like selling off our industries, has there ever been, since like that whole thing started, has there ever been a successful, you know, has that ever been successful,
No, the last large nation or nation empire to start selling off large chunks of itself simply to maintain the status and wealth of its most wealthy and its leaders was Rome around the year 200.
Right. And England's doing it. They're, you know, the prices in England are going sky high. California did it.
Yeah.
And you know what happened in California?
No, we're seeing it all over. Alex, I got to move along, but we're seeing it all over. In fact, I had a caller this morning in my local program. You know, just a couple hundred miles from here, they're selling off the highways and the toll roads. Just access, even the local access roads. It's all going to a company out of Australia that's going to build a toll road. Now, why couldn't we do that if that's how we have to fund things? But I don't even think that that's how we have to fund things. I mean, this is just terrible. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin.
Oh, quickly about Clinton. He also commented of late that George Bush is his brother.
And
back to Reagan, and then I'd like to go on real quick. Reagan, it's so ironic. The state ended up buying his property, his estate, and he also got a state pension. So what a creep.
But he was playing the game. He's
a fake. He was the first puppet they drug out of the Hollywood. But anyway, this is my opinion, Tom. The jaws of destruction, in my opinion, the two most devastating elements of America are the way the poor breed poverty and the way the rich are getting richer. Together they create the jaws of the vice that is squeezing America into a colony of the global elite while destroying all hope and a middle-class future for the majority of Americans, and George Bush is the main facilitator of this destructive process.
Yeah, well said, Armin, although I wouldn't say it was just George Bush. I'd say it's the whole conservative machine. Joe in Ramrod Key, Florida. We have about a half a minute left. Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Drawing the connection between what's going on today with our political conservatives and suicide, I could tell you I myself would be much better off, my family would be much better off, had I not even been alive or survived the cancer that I have, because that has caused my family to go so far in a hole that has destroyed my wife's credit. I can't afford the medication. I skipped doses of chemo that I'm on, oral chemo. My cancer symptoms reappear. I die of pain, and my wife struggles to make the payments for this medication, and she's an attorney who cannot even take the Georgia bar where we used to live because of her credit problems derived from my cancer. She's never had a credit problem in her life until I got sick. Tell
that's
me,
incredible,
how do I
Joe.
Go on, Tom?
That's incredible, Joe. I am so sorry to hear that. This is George Bush's America. Joe, thank you for calling and sharing your story with us. This is wrong. This is just plain old, flat-out wrong. And we can do something about it in November of 2006. Get active, my friends. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, fiendishly plot for democracy in America. Is it possible? Can America be a nation where people are not afraid to speak up and to speak out?
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
Yeah. Welcome back to the program. Yesterday, Doug Thompson, the publisher of Capitol Hill Blue, publishes an op-ed or an editorial. He calls it his rant, in which he essentially says that he knows that the Department of Homeland Security is asking questions about him. Today, he has to publish a rant to avoid going to jail, saying that he didn't know what he doesn't know, and he doesn't know what he does know, and he doesn't know, and he's not really sure, and he can't talk about it, and it's an unnamed agency with an unnamed law. So that he won't go to an undisclosed location. And is this what the founders wanted? Is it? The Declaration of Independence was the logical extension of the revolution that was started by the Boston Tea Party. It was signed by 56 people, politicians, doctors, Protestant ministers, merchants. Nine of them were farmers. Ben Franklin, a little hard to define. Mr. ADD is what I would call him. He had 37 careers in his life. The last one was creating the United States of America. He could never hold a job. Thrown out of school in the third grade. They ranged in age from their 20s to Franklin, who was in his 80s. Thomas Jefferson was 33 years old when he signed the Declaration of Independence. That was about the average age. These men were the most idealistic and determined among the colonists, while the conservatives of the day argued that America should remain a colony of England forever. These liberal radicals believed in both individual liberty and societal obligations. A nation must care for the lives of its own, guarantee liberty, and ensure its citizens' happiness, a radical concept that had never before appeared in any nation's founding document until Thomas Jefferson wrote it into the Declaration of Independence. As the signers wrote at the end of the Declaration, "We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." And it was a simple statement of fact. The day they signed that document, each legally became a traitor and was sentenced to death for treason by the legal government that controlled their lands and their homes. As Ben Franklin pointed out, they stood at a point of no return, and as he said, "Indeed, we must all hang together, otherwise we shall most assuredly hang separately." When Rhode Island's Stephen Hopkins signed the Declaration of Independence, he remarked to his friend William Ellery, "My hand trembles, but my heart does not." But Virginia's Benjamin Harrison, who weighed nearly 300 pounds, said to Massachusetts's Elbridge Gerry, a short, thin man, "With me, the hanging will be over in a minute. You're going to be dancing in the air for an hour after I'm gone." John Hancock, the wealthiest among them. By the way, Hancock's wealth in today's dollars would be well less than $1 million. The first American millionaire was in the 1790s, in today's dollars. These people were what today would be called the upper middle class. Many of them. Some of them were just, you know, middle class. They were, as I said, farmers, and I'm not talking about estate owners. John Hancock, the wealthiest among them, signed his name large enough that, as he said, "The king could read my name without glasses and can now double the reward of 500 pounds that had already been put on his head for sedition." Just 6 months later, John Hancock would lose his newborn daughter to complications of childbirth arising from his wife's fleeing the oncoming British army. He founded no dynasty. No foundations today dispense his money. His legacy is our nation. And the company that bears his name, had nothing to do with starting and is now owned by a foreign company. Another of the wealthiest of the signers was Thomas Nelson of Virginia, but a year after signing, the British had seized his home and lands. When he and George Washington attacked the British in his hometown, Nelson encouraged Washington to attack his own homestead, where British General Cornwallis had taken as his headquarters, to attack it with cannons. The house was destroyed. After the war, Nelson, unable to repay loans he'd taken out to help finance the revolution, lost his property and died in poverty at the age of 50. Robert Morris, a Philadelphia merchant, lost everything, wiped out his small fortune. Signer William Ellery of Rhode Island similarly lost everything, as did Virginia's Carter Braxton and Benjamin Harrison, Pennsylvania's George Clymer, New York's Philip Livingston, Georgia's Lyman Hall, and New Jersey's Francis Hopkinson. All of them died destitute as a consequence of having signed the Declaration of Independence. The British destroyed New York's Francis Lewis's property, threw his wife into such a hellhole of a jail that she died after 2 years of it. Three of South Carolina's four signers, Edward Rutledge, Thomas Hayward Jr., and Arthur Middleton, were captured by the British and held in a filthy, unheated prison and brutally tortured for over a year before George Washington was able to free them in a prisoner exchange. New Jersey farmer John Hart's wife died shortly after he signed the Declaration of Independence. His 13 children were scattered among sympathetic families to hide them from the British and the conservative loyalists. He never saw them again, dying alone and racked with grief 3 years later. Altogether, 17 of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence were completely wiped out by the war they declared. New Jersey State Supreme Court Justice Richard Stockton took his wife and children into hiding after he signed the declaration, but conservatives loyal to the crown turned him in. He was so badly beaten and starved in the British prison that he died before the war was over. His home was looted. His wife and children lived the rest of their lives as paupers. Altogether, 9 of the men in that room died. 4 lost their children as a direct result of putting their names to the Declaration of Independence. Every single one had to flee his home. And after the war, 12 returned to find only rubble. After the war was over and the conservatives had fled to Canada and England, the survivors of the new American nation met to put into final form the legal structure of the nation they had just birthed. It was not to be a nation of cynical, selfish libertarians who believed the highest value was individual freedom and independence from society, or that the greatest motivator was greed. It was not to be a kingdom ruled by a warlord elite. It was not to be an oligarchy ruled by the wealthy families. It was not to be a theocracy where religious leaders made the rules, as had been several of the states, particularly Massachusetts. And it was not to be a feudal nation ruled by the rich, as Benjamin Franklin told Philadelphia's Mrs. Powell after she asked him what sort of nation had been conceived in the Constitutional Convention of 1787. He said, "It was to be a republic, madam, if you can keep it." Iraqis wanting to vote in the Iraqi election, Iraqis living in the United States, displaced Iraqis living in the United States wanting to vote in their own election, were given places all over the United States, satellite voting offices, so they could vote. We have right now 700,000 people from New Orleans scattered across the United States, 75% of them African Americans. Not only is this government not giving them satellite locations to vote, like we gave the Iraqis, they will not even send them absentee ballots. Instead, they are going to receive information packets about how they can request an absentee ballot and how to vote by absentee ballot. And the address the city has on file may be unreliable, as they note over at the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org. In response, local leaders are wondering why Iraqis living in the United States were given this right, that is to have these satellite voting places, yet African Americans are not. The citizens of Louisiana. Are these the ideals that this country was founded on? Somehow I think not. The right wing now suggesting, I mean, this is incredible about this law in South Dakota. We'll get to that in just a second. 16 minutes after the hour, it's the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ghosts and chickens in the sky. No, that's a different song. Welcome back, my friends. I actually have a Ghost Chickens in the Sky song that's to that tune. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. It's about what happened when Colonel Sanders died and he got up to heaven and discovered God was a chicken. He was a little upset. Anyhow, as they point out over at thinkprogress.org, the media continues to report that the South Dakota abortion ban contains, quote, no exceptions for cases of rape or incest, end quote. Reporters evidently missed the comments of South Dakota State Representative Roger Hunt, Republican, the main sponsor of the legislation, who told Time magazine that he had carved out a little gray area into the bill to allow for abortions in case of rape or incest. In other words, this is from Time magazine, okay? I'm quoting from Time magazine here.
In other words, a woman presenting herself to an emergency room immediately after a rape, Hunt says, would be able to use emergency contraception. The trick is that she has to do it within the first few days after the assault before any test can determine whether she has become pregnant in the first place. The lawmakers concluded that it's okay for a rape victim to have an abortion so long as she doesn't know for certain that she's doing it. Number one. I mean, isn't this weird? And then State Senator Bill Napoli, a Republican, on the PBS NewsHour, said that there could be exceptions. He said, a real-life description to me would be a rape victim, brutally raped, savage. The girl was a virgin. She was religious. She planned on saving her virginity until she was married. She was brutalized and raped, sodomized as bad as you can possibly make it, and impregnated. I mean, that girl could be so messed up physically and psychologically that carrying that child could very well threaten her life. End of quote. In other words, according to lawmakers in South Dakota, you can have an abortion after rape or incest, but only if you are a virgin, you are religious, you are brutally sodomized, and you're not sure whether the rapist or family member actually impregnated you. I mean, figure out the logic of this. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Jeffrey Feldman of Frame Shop. Frame Shop is open. He says the rape is the frame. This is the frame that the folks are missing. But Time Magazine has apparently nailed this thing. They've got it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jay in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Hey, Will Splitzer had on Mike Brown on 7:30 Friday as well as Thursday, the whole half hour. I saw it, but he tried to get him pinned in a few different ways. One specific point was that when he asked him, you know, people say were you Arabian horse judge? How does that qualify you? And his defense was, well, I had other jobs before that legally.
Yeah, I saw the interview.
Did you think that he had any merit to all of his defenses, or he was just talking out of his butt?
No, I mean, at one point, Wolf Blitzer said, weren't you a crony? And Brownie said, yeah, I got the job because I was a friend of Joe Albaugh's. He says, I wasn't his college roommate. I was living with my girlfriend or wife at the time when I was in college, but we were friends. That's how I got the job. You know, he admitted that. And that's, you know, the Bush administration's all about cronies. And he tried to put a patina on it, you know, that he'd been involved with emergency this or that as a lawyer for this or that. Yeah, bottom line is, Brownie, A, didn't have the qualifications that were really necessary to be head of FEMA. B, the Bush administration had been taking apart FEMA by demoting it from a cabinet-level position so that the head of the emergency management agency can't go to the president and say, hey, I need some help. Instead, he had to go to Chertoff. C, Chertoff clearly dropped the ball on this, and this is the point that Brownie's been making all over the place. And D, in all probability, Chertoff dropped the ball because Bush was responding to nothing. He was saying, well, we pray there'll be no loss of life. And then he goes off to feed cake to John McCain, to play golf, to do a fundraiser for the Republican Party, and to play the guitar with some country western singer.
Yeah, that's the point. I keep harping the people who support him. How do you defend and forgive him playing golf on day two? And I actually met a guy who said he's probably making decisions with important people on the golf course.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the bottom line is, if you don't believe in government, then you don't believe that the government should do anything. And Bush doesn't believe in government. He is following that policy of Reagan.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And that's just his philosophy. You know, government has no role in helping the people. Government should give money to corporations, period. Government is an opportunity for the rich to get richer. End of discussion. Because that's how Bush lived his whole entire life. I mean, look at the millions that he made with an investment of a few $100,000 on the Texas Rangers were the consequence of money being taken from the taxpayers by the government using eminent domain. I mean, they took all that land to build that stadium, and it was paid for by the taxpayers of Arlington, Texas.
Hey, don't forget to remind your listeners about the statistic that the CEO ratio to average worker is 430 these days as opposed to 80-1 under Reagan, right?
Yeah, it was around 80-1 when Reagan came into office. It was 30-1 in 1970. And it's 30-1 right now in Sweden. In most of Europe, it's between 30 and 50-1. The rest of the world looks at us and says, this is obscene. This is nuts. These people have gone over the edge. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Tom in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Tom.
Hey, good morning. Good to talk to you again.
Hey, Tom, I'm going to have to ask you to hold on here.
No problem.
The break just caught us, and I wasn't anticipating. I'm going to just put you on hold. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where you get your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity every single day, Monday through Friday, noon to 3 Eastern, what is it, 9 to noon Pacific, or however, whenever you get played on your local station. We'll be right back, 27 minutes past.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world. It's hard to get by, just a part of smile.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour here in the real free speech zone. No barbed wire. You're not going to get dragged off if you got a no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car. No RNC passes required. Welcome back to our program. The place where it's easy, as easy to tune in as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Tom in Vancouver, Washington on the line. Hey, Tom.
Hey. That's,
welcome
that's
back.
No barbed wire and no bird shot.
There you go. No bird shot either. You're safe here. What's up?
I'm calling about a statement I heard last week and for the few weeks about Halliburton having a contract to build bases for the detainees here.
Detention centers, yeah.
Detention centers. And somewhere, I didn't get the exact amount. It sounded as though it was $278 million and may have been $378
million. Yeah, it was 300 and change. It was a little under $400 million, which okay. Isn't a lot of money, by the way, if you're talking about, you know, if somebody's imagining some massive network of detention, you know, of you know, like Germany had some, you know, well over 100
yep.
concentration camps inside Germany by the end of the war. You couldn't build that with $400 million. I think that what this is about is a temporary or stopgap solution to the catch-and-release problem that they have down along the southern border, which is they catch people who have come into the United States, and they don't have the jail space for them. So they tell them, hey, you know, you're illegal, we've caught you, your court date is next Thursday at 2 o'clock, please show up, and they let them go. And 90% of those people never show up, and probably more than 90% of them. And so, you know, some bright bulb in Congress said, well, why don't we build some detention centers for these folks? And my understanding is that that's what this is about. Now, you know, frankly, my solution to the illegal immigrant problem is very simple. Put into jail, instead of putting the illegal immigrants into jail, put into jail any CEO, any business owner who hires one. If you did that, if you started enforcing that law tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, you would have 11 million illegal immigrants standing on the Mexican border trying to get back into Mexico.
But
you know, that won't go for the CEOs.
But that would be within the same context of if you want to have a war on drugs, you put the bankers that are laundering the money into jail, the billions of billions
sure.
every year, and stop the access to clean their money up.
Yeah, well, there's the war on drugs is a whole different thing. You know, frankly, I
well,
think
right.
that the war on drugs is a sham, and that what we're trying to do is deal with a medical problem using criminal means. Just like, frankly, just like the war on illegal immigration, to the extent that people use that metaphor, they're trying to use, again, legal means to solve what is really an economic problem.
But
it's really
don't we have don't we have military bases in the United States, literally all over, that are closed, that for, I would guess, less than a million, that you could revamp those places, put a security fence around it, house these people there. They have mess halls, medical centers, exercise areas. They have mass quantities of people can be put and sheltered in those areas.
Yeah.
And for a lot less than $400 million, and have some centrally located throughout the states instead of having to fly people back and forth, which is going to be another expense.
Well, you know, in my life, I've only been on a couple of military bases, and the ones that I were on, that I was on, and lived on one for a while. My sense of it was that it would be, my sense of it now, looking back on it, is that it would be very difficult to turn those into detention centers. I mean, they're really not built to keep people in; they're built to house people. I think that the needs are different. So, I mean, this might be a reasonable thing. Who knows? In the context of the assumption that the only way that you can deal with illegal immigration is to lock people up. As I said, I think that that's a flawed assumption. But that's the assumption under which most of Congress is dealing. So I'm not sure that this Halliburton deal is you know, the edge of the evil empire. Frankly, I'm much more concerned with these national security letters, with what's happening with Doug Thompson and folks like him. And that may be happening to you and me, Tom.
I didn't realize what's going on with that letter.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll give you the rant. I'm going to drop the call, but thanks for the call. I appreciate it. And yesterday, Doug Thompson, the publisher of Capitol Hill Blue, CapitolHillBlue.com is their website. Yesterday, he publishes an article saying that, you know, essentially, I mean, these are my words, not his, so that he doesn't get in trouble because he's got to walk this very delicate line. So my understanding of what he wrote was that he had learned that a national security letter had been issued against him. That is to say that the feds wanted all of the information about him from his internet service provider and from his business. And the only problem is he owns his business. And so basically he was being asked to rat out himself. However, he was told that if he did so, it would be a crime for him to tell himself that he was looking into himself. And then today he had to, in order to avoid going to jail, he had to publish a mea culpa, basically, an article saying, well, you know, it's this undisclosed law, this undisclosed person, it's just absolutely, you can see the whole thing over at CapitolHillBlue.com. It's absolutely incredible. David Sirota has done an absolutely brilliant job. He's done some of the greatest writing, I'd say, over the last 4 or 5 years in this country. He has a new book coming up. It's called Hostile Takeover, which is not out yet, so I can't plug the thing or speak to it, but if it's anything like the kind of writing that he's been doing over the last few years, it's going to be wonderful, and I'm looking forward to it coming out. And he, in a recent blog, he talks about how what he calls the most virulent myth of wealth and poverty, and this thing, this is all over the place. Virulent, I lack a better word for it. This is one of the most toxic stories that we have. The idea that people choose their economic position in society, that the poor choose to be poor. He says the rationale for pushing this propaganda is obvious. The wealthy and powerful create a rhetorical framework for an economic agenda that's aimed at delivering more and more public assets to fewer and fewer private interests. This is what an oligarchy is all about. The rich not only get richer and richer, and the poor not only get poorer and poorer, and the middle class gets wiped out, because an active and aggressive middle class is a threat to an oligarchy. You can't have a strong middle class and have an oligarchy, because a strong middle class will always demand a democracy, because democracy is the natural state of human beings. So not only do they have to wipe that out, but that the oligarchs, the wealth, the powers that be, are using the systems of government and the mythology associated with this to increase their own wealth. Yeah, it's really amazing. It's really amazing how if you have a million, making the second million is not that big a challenge. If you have 2 million, making 4 million is not that hard over a couple of years, you know, just some smart investing. If you got 10 million making 20 million, not that big a challenge. But if you're making $40,000 a year and you want to go to $80,000 a year, good luck. So there's this whole metaphor. George Will laid this thing out in his column. It's syndicated all across the United States. I'm quoting George Will now. He says, the new paradigm is of behavior-driven poverty that results from individuals' non-material deficits. This is almost like psychobabble. They're non-material deficits. In other words, there's something going on in their brain. He says it results from a scarcity of certain habits and mores, punctuality, hygiene, industriousness, deferral of gratification, etc., that are not developed in disorganized homes. I know people who write about attention deficit disorder who say the same thing. Oh, yes, they're just bad people. They're disorganized. You know, it's amazing. During the potato famine in the 1840s, 1850s in Ireland, when 1 million people died of starvation, Ireland, two amazing things about this. Number one, Ireland during that time was actually exporting food. They exported more than enough food to feed all the Irish. They were exporting primarily wheat, and they were exporting it to the United Kingdom. One of the reasons why the Irish to this day look at the UK with a bit of a jaundiced eye. And number two, during that time, the Irish were considered such essentially subhuman criminals by the British that the British put together a fleet of ships to deport them to Australia and the United States. We had a penal colony. Now, this is a little earlier than that. We had a penal colony down in Georgia. The state of Georgia was originally a penal colony for Great Britain. When we stopped taking them in the United States, we refused to take any more British prisoners. They started sending them to Australia. Well, oddly enough, once the Irish got some self-governance and some democracy and they were able to put together their economy, they weren't all criminals anymore. So it's not about non-material deficits. It's not about habits and mores of the failure of punctuality, hygiene, and industriousness, the inability to defer gratification. That's absolute nonsense. What it's about is a system of government and an economic system that allows people to be successful or that inhibits them from success. Charles Dickens, whose own father was thrown into debtor's prison, writes about this so eloquently in most of his books. The one most people know, A Christmas Carol. Ebenezer Scrooge, part of the ownership class, the ownership society, to paraphrase George W. Bush. And his employee, part of the working poor. What George W. Bush and the conservatives, the Republicans in the House and the Senate, the Republicans in the United States would like all of the middle class to be, the working poor. Please, Mr. Scrooge, may I have health care for my son?
No, you can't.
How about a lump of coal? It's kind of cold here.
No, it'll cost an extra pence.
This is the vision for America conservatives are holding, and it's not the vision for America that Americans have. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're going to have to serve somebody.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Time for a Walmart alert.
I hate Walmart. If you didn't hear the story, well, here's how it is. Big company sell the low cost. Drive mom and pop out of business. Spread a suit all over the land. One big square store. I stand for brand, and that's why I hate Walmart.
Yes, indeed. Computer store owner Charles Smith is the first to admit, writes Abigail Goldman in the LA Times, Washington Post News Service, the first to admit the T-shirts and mugs he designed to lampoon Walmart stores are in bad taste. But Smith had wanted to make a point by comparing the retail giant company to the Nazis. So he created slogans playing off the Bentonville, Arkansas company's familiar logo, including the I Love Wall Star O-Cost. They have family values. And this is what the T-shirt says. I love the wall of cost. They have family values, and their alcohol, tobacco, and firearms are 20% off. So this isn't the T-shirt. Walmart wasn't amused, writes Abigail Goldman. The company launched a legal battle by writing a cease and desist demand that forced Smith to file suit Monday in federal court in Atlanta with the help of Ralph Nader's legal aid group, Public Citizen, in order to sell the products. At stake, Smith says, is his right to publicly criticize the world's largest retailer or any other company. In his lawsuit, Smith asked that the court rule that his products are protected by the First Amendment and that they don't infringe on Walmart's trademark. Walmart says, for their part, Walmart will aggressively protect our brand by taking appropriate legal action against those who inappropriately use our name or improperly profit from our name. It's from Walmart spokeswoman Sarah Clark. The case, notes Abigail Goldman, is the latest to pit corporate trademark rights against free speech rights. In a suit that ended in 2004, for example, Mattel, Inc. lost to an artist who used Barbie dolls and photographs parodying the iconic toys. you recall that parody is one of the protected uses. It's one of the protected fair uses, kind of the exceptions to the Trademark Act. First Amendment rights might win out in Smith's case as well, one legal expert said. Smith is a 48-year-old father of three from Conyers, Georgia. Said he made the designs because he concluded that Walmart's effects on people and neighborhoods was like the destruction wrought by the Holocaust. Well, I'd say that's a little hyperbolic, but in my opinion, so is Walmart's response. But, you know, company's got to do what it's got to do, right? We'll see. In the meantime, students have to do what they have to do. The Republican-led Congress and President Bush, this is from the San Francisco Chronicle, Zachary Coley, or Kiel, the Republican-led Congress and President Bush are facing growing anger on college campuses. Why? Well, in order to have his tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. You know, George W. Bush, first of all, he said, you know, if we give $500,000 to each, if we give $500,000 each to millionaires and billionaires, they will each create one job with that $550,000. No, I'm serious. He really said that. He said if we give a rich person a half a million dollars, they will create one job. Randy's shaking his head over here. No, I'm serious. It's true. He said do the math. $550 billion divided by a million, right? Million goes into 550,000, the same as 100,000 goes. No, I can't break it. Anyhow, a million goes into 550,000, the same as one goes into $550 billion, the same as one goes into $550,000. Here's George Bush.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than a million new jobs.
So there you go, $550,000 per person. He came right out and said this. He said it over and over and over again on the campaign trail in 2000 and 2002, pushing his tax thing. And the media never, nobody ever apparently pulled out a calculator. But in any case, we got our he got his tax cuts, and his millionaires and billionaires got their $550,000. And what are they doing with that money? Well, they're investing it overseas. In fact, interesting article in yesterday's Wall Street Journal. Maybe it was today's Wall Street Journal about how, yeah, here it is right here. The headline, forget xenophobia, go abroad for gains. For American Mutual Fund investors, this is Ian McDonald's Fund Fiend column in today's Wall Street Journal. He says, for American Mutual Fund investors, jingoism is on life support, and that may not be a bad thing. Last year, foreign stock funds soaked up nearly $131 billion in net investments, more than three times the amount taken in by U.S. stock funds after redemptions, according to the Financial Research Corporation. The beat went on in January when foreign funds took in $27.8 billion compared with a net shrinkage for U.S. stock funds. So we gave that $550 billion in so-called tax relief to millionaires and billionaires. And what are they doing with that money? They're buying stock in foreign companies. Well, why would they do that? Because the foreign companies are buying America. So I guess what goes around comes around. But in any case, in order to pay for this, because it didn't create those, well, it might have created a million jobs. But, I mean, come on. We're going to create a million jobs that pay $20,000 or $10,000 a year, a million Walmart jobs, you know, minimum wage jobs, more or less. And somebody's got to pay the bill. So Bush has decided that students are going to pay the bill. In the so-called deficit reduction bill last month, they cut $12 billion from student loan programs. This is where I started with this thing, anger on college campuses. Lawmakers already had approved a steep increase in interest rates for Stafford loans. Nearly 10 million students are using these things. These rate increases take effect July 1st. Department of Education figures suggest that at least 400,000 qualified students did not enroll in four-year colleges each year because of financial barriers. Average debt of college graduates just in the last 10 years jumped 50%. Stafford loans, they're going from 4.7% this year up to 6.8%. In July. I mean, this is nuts. I mean, this is social mobility, is education. And we're making it impossible for the middle class to have access to. It's an absolute tragedy. This is Bushonomics. This is Reaganomics. This is conservative economics. This is the destruction of the American middle class so that an oligarchy can rule our nation. And it ain't good. It's not America. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Pioneers, founded in 1990 as a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. They have an annual conference, it pops up all over the world, various places. And I've spoken there a couple times. We do a Pioneer segment, pioneers.org, by the way, their website. We do a Pioneer segment every weekend. And our guest this week, our Pioneers guest, is Margaret. Margaret, is it? Would you please pronounce your last name for me?
Yeah, it's Adamek. It's unfortunately three syllables and six letters, so it's a mouthful.
Adamek. Okay, thank you. Margaret or Maggie Adamek?
Yes.
And your website, Radiant Recovery.
RadiantRecovery.com. That's actually the website of my partner in crime, and I'll talk a little bit more about that today, that provides resources for folks who are interested in this, connected kind of directly to their own health and well-being, and I'll talk a little bit more if they want information for community interventions, how they can do that.
Okay, well, tell me about the Sugar Project.
Sure. About 6 years ago, I was struggling with some health issues and things like fatigue, low energy, anxiety, and had a pretty, what would be considered a pretty clean burning diet, you know, very few animal products, lots of olive oil, whole grains, and tons of vegetables, and didn't feel great. In fact, felt pretty cruddy. So I knew something was up, and I started digging around, and about the same time my father died of cancer and had struggled with some of these similar issues through his life, and we sort of had this joke in my extended family that the women got fat and diabetic and the men got alcoholic and sort of the Norwegian side of things. So I knew there was some familial stuff that was going on, and despite the fact that I ate healthy and appeared healthy, I didn't feel healthy, and that's when I stumbled across Kathleen DeMaison's work. And in essence, what that did is shifting some fairly basic things in my diet that aren't, you know, rocket science in terms of changes, made such a profound difference in how I felt that I became really intrigued with what her assertion was, which is that food impacts body chemistry, and that she was actually able to use this approach in treating chemical dependency, particularly with alcoholics, where the standard treatment success rate is about 20% with a 12-step model and psychotherapeutic treatment. And what she found by using a food-based model in controlled studies is that about 92% of the subjects in the study got sober and stayed sober for an extended period of time. So after I went through this process myself, which was really just to sort of deal with my energy and anxiety issues, I began to look at some of the tribal communities that I had worked with over the course of my career in northern Minnesota, where there were sort of these four major issues that they were struggling with in terms of their public health profile, which was type 2 diabetes, obesity, depression, and addiction. And then, of course, you looked at their dietary profile, and you could see that those issues...
A lot of Twinkies,
a lot of commodity foods, a lot of refined carbohydrates, very little dense, high-quality protein, low in fresh produce, and low in healthy fats. And what I said was, wow, you know, they could do some, reclaim their traditional diet, and just through a food-based approach alone, they could actually really address, particularly addiction was one that I was interested in because it had such a pervasive and stubborn and resistant influence in Native communities. So I went and talked to the elders that I worked with and said, you know, I think this might work and you could reclaim culture and restore your traditional food system while you were treating addiction. And that's sort of how the whole thing unfolded. And I found Kathleen. She's a best-selling author, and I emailed her thinking an important author would never email me back, and she emailed me back right away and said I'd be happy to be of service to the Native community. And so that's how the Sugar Project was born, and our main emphasis now is to look at food-based models that treat neurochemical deficits that are exacerbated by the contemporary American diet. And those resources that we help create and provide are for individuals and families and community enterprises like a K-12 school, for example, that might be interested in changing their school meals program, and then also to chemical dependency facilities or on Indian reservations, for example. It might be a Head Start program or an elder's diabetes meals program or something like that. So we offer a variety of options and ways of collaborating with folks.
You are so right on with us. In 1978, 26, 7, 8 years ago, My wife Louise and I started a community for abused kids in New Hampshire called the New England Salem Children's Village.
Uh-huh.
And the program was based on a Whole Foods, no sugar diet, a vegetarian diet, absolute Whole Foods. And also there's no television. And it's still there and it's running really, really well. It's one of the more well respected programs in New England. And then about 8 years ago, we started a school there for children with ADHD. It's called the Hunter School, hunterschool.org on the web. And out of this model of hunters in a farmer's world, you know, that these kids are really designed to be Aboriginal hunters rather than, you know, modern white bread agriculturalists.
Right.
And we have gotten, and over, you know, 2.5 decades, spectacular results with this. Back in the 70s when I was running the program, I met William Duffy, the guy who wrote the book Sugar Blues.
Sure.
You familiar with that?
Yep.
He was a very strange character, but it was an extraordinary book he wrote. And so I'm really glad to hear that this is getting out there and you're doing this. I noticed a few years ago, five, 6 years ago, that there seemed to be an absolute statistical correlation between the amount of high fructose corn syrup in the United States marketplace, because it really, I mean, it was invented in, as I recall, the 70s. Maybe it was the late 60s. This is a relatively new chemical in our food supply. It's very different from the old Karo syrup that I grew up with. If you track the amount of high fructose corn syrup in our diets and you track obesity, that they seem to, those curves seem to lay on top of each other. And I've, for a couple of years here on this program, have been suggesting to people the best diet I know of to lose weight is to simply take all corn syrup out of your diet. It's amazing how many foods it's in. And we've had people call in and say, oh, I lost 10 pounds, I lost 15 pounds. Not like I'm trying to run some kind of diet program here or something. But is that consistent with what you've found?
Well, there's a number of ways you can talk about it. First of all, the USDA themselves, their research service, reports that since 1970, so in the last 35 years, individual per capita, you know, annual consumption of high fructose corn syrup has increased by over 4,000%. A 4,000% increase per person per year. You know, soft drink consumption among kids went up.
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, it's in ketchup.
It's in ketchup, it's in lunch meat, it's in bread, it's in salad dressing, it's everywhere. And so the question of avoiding it is a challenging one, of course, and what we're seeing is this huge increase in high fructose corn syrup. Now, what you also see is that, you know, the amount of soft drinks that kids have started consuming in the last 20 years has climbed by 70% for 2 to 18-year-olds, 83% for young adults. And then, of course, milk consumption's dropped by about 40% since the early 70s. Now, here's a scary statistic, too. After bread, the second highest amount of carbohydrates in the American children's diets comes from sweetened soft drinks. And almost all of those sweetened soft drinks are sweetened with high fructose corn syrup. And we've got some intriguing research that's disputed yet, but what they're finding is that high fructose corn syrup is actually metabolized differently than sugar.
Right.
So not only are people drinking more sweetener, there's more significantly more refined carbohydrates in their diet. What they're finding is corn syrup actually creates fat deposits that deposit differently and more abundantly in the body. So it's not just...
And are harder to get rid of.
Much harder to get rid of, that's right.
Yeah.
Now, one of the tricks, of course, with high fructose corn syrup isn't just the added calories, but the fact that we metabolize it differently. The fact that there is so much in our diet, one of the things that the Sugar Project really takes a hard look at is what is the impact of all those refined carbohydrates, and I'm not just including high fructose corn syrup, I include all the hamburger buns and the pizza crust and the white flour tortillas that people are getting because, you know, 1 in 3 kids in the United States eats fast food every day. So all of the refined carbohydrates, this huge glut that's in their diet, that's an unprecedented experiment in human history. What we're noticing is that there is some very strong ties between that kind of dietary profile and the way dopamine functioning and serotonin functioning and opiate functioning work in the brain.
Right,
so
and this
not
has
only
to do with depression, with mental functioning, mental clarity.
And things like aggression, violence, impulse control.
Sure.
And the scary one is addiction. There's a wonderful scientist at Princeton University. He's the tallest scientist I've ever met. He's about 6'7". And he has done a bunch of research the last few years, Dr. Bart Hobel, on the impact of sugar on the dopamine and opiate systems in the brain. And what he's found out is that sugar can evoke a dependent state in both the opiate system and the dopamine system that is similar to other opiates like morphine, alcohol, heroin. It's not as severe, of course, a response, but it can create the same kind of system of dependency. And what is really frightening about his research is that he did animal studies on these, and what he found is that he called them giving rats binge doses of sweetened, drink for the rats to drink. And what he found is those binge doses were equivalent to a 20-ounce serving of soft drink for a child. So you take a kid's body weight, you give them a 20-ounce serving of Mountain Dew once or twice a day, and what begins to happen is their opiate system begins to become
right. They become addicted to it. Maggie, we're out of time, but
right.
It's an amazing story. RadiantRecovery.com, the website
right.
where people can find out more information about this.
That's
it's marvelous.
Right.
The Sugar Project out of the University of Minnesota. Thanks so much for being with us,
Thank
Maggie.
Thank you. Take care.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend.
And welcome back, my friends.
I'm not some daydream seller. I do not pretend.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, back when we had a problem down in Central America with people wanting democracy, we sent down John Negroponte. And good old Death Squad John helped, according to some folks on the ground, helped organize death squads out of El Salvador, and they pretty soon people started showing up with bullet holes in their heads. There was an article in the paper yesterday about how one of the chief morgue guys, what do you call these guys, coroners in Baghdad, has just fled the country for his life after revealing that some 9,000 bodies have shown up dead with signs of torture. He accuses the Interior Ministry, that would be the equivalent of our Department of Homeland Security, of doing this. And if you go back and look, you will find it's really interesting. John Negroponte was our ambassador over there for a little while. Before that, no death squad deaths. Within weeks of Negroponte's arriving, suddenly there were these death squads. Suddenly, corpses were turning up all over the place. Well, he's now the head of U.S. intelligence. And as they report over at the Think Progress blog, on many a work day lunchtime, the nominal boss of U.S. intelligence, John D. Negroponte, can be found at a private club in downtown Washington, getting a massage, taking a swim, and having lunch, followed by a good cigar and a perusal of the daily papers in the club's library. He spends 3 days there every day, Monday through Friday, gripes a senior counterterrorism official. So, you know, it's hard work organizing death squads, and when you retire from it, I guess you're entitled to a cigar, or at least so the Bush administration considers. 13 hours. Anyhow, good old Death Squad John, on he goes. Bush has never met a spending bill he didn't like, by the way. We'll get to that in just a minute. But first, in South Dakota. South Dakota has passed this law. I mentioned this in the first hour of the program. But I'm sure that there were some out there who were just incredulous. They're going, what? What's this? What are you talking about? Here's this guy, State Senator Bill Napoli. He's on PBS's NewsHour program. And he says that even though they've passed a law that says the only way that a woman can get an abortion is if her life is at risk, what this means is that if she's a Christian and she's a virgin and she gets raped, then her life is at risk. And so she can have an abortion. Here's the audio.
A real life description to me would be a rape victim. Brutally raped, savaged. The girl was a virgin. She was religious. She planned on saving her virginity until she was married. She was brutalized and raped, sodomized, as bad as you can possibly make it, and is impregnated. I mean, that girl could be so messed up physically and psychologically that carrying that child could very well threaten her life.
So, You get this. The right wingers have a new definition of compassion. If a girl is religious and a virgin and she gets raped, then she can have an abortion. But if a woman has ever had sex before and doesn't go to church regularly, or is but doesn't go to their church, and so they don't consider her religious, if she's not planning on saving her virginity until she's married, then she doesn't qualify for an abortion. Is something seem a little strange here? I've been saying all along, this is not about abortion. This is about the control of women. This is we're talking about going back to Bradwell versus Illinois, the 1873 Supreme Court decision, when the Supreme Court ruled that women were the legal property of men. That is what these people want to take this country back to. That's what they want to take women back to in the United States. That's what this is all about, ultimately. And that's why, constantly, when you look at these anti-abortion crusades, you see that there are men leading them. Ken in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Ken, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, Bush has already escaped. What's going to happen is Cheney's going to retire for medical reasons of coming the summer. Okay, Bush is going to name McCain or somebody else to be vice president.
Yeah, I've been predicting this for 2 years, Ken, although I don't think that it would be McCain.
Let me finish, Tom. Yeah. Now, what happens is that if they continue to hold the houses, they'll continue on through. If the houses are flipped, then Bush will resign for the good of the country. And the new president, McCain or whoever he is going to let Bush go for the good of the country, going to pardon him. Which means he's going to get away with the whole thing. If not, it's going to go up to the federal courts or the Supreme Court. Let me see how that'll work out.
Yeah, it could be. You know, a lot depends on how much of a holding action they can put into place. By the way, your idea of McCain being the guy that they appoint as VP, there's a battle going on inside the Republican Party, just like there is inside the Democratic Party right now. In the Democratic Party, there's a battle going on between the real Democrats, the old-fashioned, they're called progressives now, but the old-fashioned FDR Democrats, and the DLC Democrats, the so-called New Democrats, the light Republicans. And in the Republican Party, there's a battle going on between the fascists and the old-fashioned Republicans. And McCain is one of the old-fashioned Republicans, and Cheney and Bush are part of the fascist wing. And so I frankly doubt that they would appoint McCain unless the old-fashioned Republicans actually won that internal battle. And if they did, that would be the first indication of it. And they're actually starting to get their oats. They're starting to feel their oats. The Susan Collins and George Voinoviches and all these folks, they are conservative, they are Republicans, but they are not fascists. And they're starting to assert some authority, some power here. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And we're going to take it off. We're going to take this country back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Just a short and quick overview of the headlines here. Jeffrey Fastow says Enron executives approved deals to hide losses. This is from the New York Times. Interesting. Ex-CFO says Enron's leaders discussed the questionable nature of some partnerships, but ultimately approved them. Over in Iraq, the Shiites are trying to block the start of Iraq's parliament on Sunday. They're a little upset that their prime ministerial nominee, is being asked to back off. Not happy about this at all. Bombings in India. We just gave them nuclear weapons, even though they won't sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Bombings in India raise fear of sectarian violence. A series of apparently coordinated bombs went off in the ancient Hindu holy city of Banaras in eastern India this evening. And in the meantime, nukes for India, no problem. Nukes for Iran, Dick Cheney said today, the international community is prepared to impose meaningful consequences. Meaningful consequences on Iran. He's also said,
I've been waiting for you. We meet again at last. The circle is now complete. I am the master.
Yeah. So, anyhow, it's almost not funny anymore because it's so much seems to be that. Time for
Now, the Delay Political Death Watch.
And Larry in Seattle, Washington, welcome to the program. I understand you have something to contribute to our political Delay Political Death Watch?
Absolutely.
Okay, go for it, Larry.
Well, this may all become moot by this evening should the primary go down on Tom DeLay's head. He's got three contenders running against him, so he may lose, and this all may just go away. But there's a documentary movie that's being released called, well, let's see, where is that? The Big Buy, How Tom DeLay Stole Congress.
Mm-hmm.
This has been put together by some gentlemen, Mark Birnbaum and Jim Schermbeck, who spent about $100,000 in 3 years following Tom around, his from his push to redraw the congressional district starting back in 2002. And then, of course, it mushroomed into a nationally watched partisan standoff. And then we saw Democratic lawmakers fleeing across state lines. We saw Tom DeLay using the Homeland Security mechanism to find out where those guys went, violating various laws along the way, using those for political purposes.
Yep, and this is by my old friend Robert Greenwald, the Hollywood producer and liberal provocateur.
Absolutely.
A brilliant guy. In fact, we have the trailer for this, Larry, a special treat for you. Thank you for calling and alerting us to this. Let me just play the... Here's the trailer. And by the way, you can find it at TomDeLayMovie.com. Here's the trailer for this movie, and there's one part toward the end, and I'll just pop in and yell Abramoff when it comes, where Jack Abramoff, because you can't see it, you can only hear it right now on the radio, but you can see it online, where it's actually Jack Abramoff saying, we all want to grow up to be Tom DeLay, or words to that effect. When we get to it, you'll hear it. Here's the trailer for the Tom DeLay movie.
By the time we finish this poker game, there may not be a federal government left.
That's DeLay.
It'd suit me just fine. I would like to eliminate the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, HUD, the National Endowment for the Arts. We ought to zero them out. The National Endowment for the Humanities. We ought to zero them out. We're going to completely redesign our government.
Tom DeLay is astonishing.
I like him. And plus, when he's over there, we get our votes through the House.
He needed the House of Representatives to redistrict the state of Texas.
They flooded the state House elections with money.
Texas law makes it a felony for a corporation to contribute money to a political campaign.
It's a huge crime.
Texas is clear. Corporate contributions are illegal.
The DeLay PAC had actually been keeping two sets of books.
Ronnie Earl said, "You can't break the law in Texas and brag about it."
The indictment charges DeLay with conspiring.
He acts as if he doesn't have to answer to anyone.
This is not about Democrats and Republicans. This is about cops and robbers.
Tom DeLay is who all of us want to be.
That's Abramoff.
You're here.
Thank God Tom DeLay is the majority leader in the House.
That's Jack Abramoff. Amazing. Amazing. So that's the trailer. You can hear it over at TomDeLayMovie.com. You see it as well. And I'm not sure that all the details on the release of the movie, but Robert Greenwald's produced that thing. He's the guy who did the Walmart movie. He's the one who did the Outfoxed movie. Robert Greenwald, in fact, I am in at least one, maybe two of his movies. I'm in the one on, Unprecedented? Yes, Unprecedented, about the theft of the election in 2000. And you can buy the movie at... Alex Goldmark, our board op and engineer in New York, tells me that you can buy this movie online right now. So that's absolutely great. That is absolutely great. And of course, Bill O'Reilly. This is a plug for another Greenwald movie.
Well, the shut up line has happened only once in 6 years.
You want to know what
shut
I'm
up.
Doing?
Shut up.
Ask
well,
me to shut up about
sex.
What?
Listen, who cut his mic?
No, that's
shut up.
Not
yeah, get 35
up.
Minutes. Shut
and it is our duty as loyal Americans
to shut up and shut up publicly. We expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up. Okay. So you keep your mouth shut.
In a democracy, you don't have to shut up. Speak up.
Actually, my bad. That wasn't a Greenwald movie. That was, that's something else. But in any case, it's well said. Brian in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hey, Brian, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman program. What's up?
Hi, Tom. You were talking about immigration last hour, and I don't believe the cruel and dumb approach of Tom Tancredo and Pat Buchanan is going to – I agree with you. It's not the way to go. You were talking also about –
You mean throw them in jail or shoot them as they climb over the wall?
Oh, God. You were talking about immigrants and like my Irish, your German immigrant forebears.
Yeah, mine are actually Norwegian, but
Norwegian.
Same difference.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. The U.S.-Mexican War, you remember the San Patricios Battalion, 1847-1850 War? They were mostly Irish and German immigrants. They were press-ganged into service. But they saw the horrible way that the American troops were destroying the Mexican churches and oppressing the Mexican people and torturing them, basically. And it would be the same thing as if in here in Boston, a South Boston Irish, South Boston or East Boston Italian Americans, if they saw the authorities burn down their churches, they'd be up in arms too. And the Germans.
And by the way, they were. I mean, there was a time,
Germans,
Brian.
The Irish immigrants were. The San Patricio's battalion was mostly German German immigrants who had press ganged, and some Irish immigrants, and many of them ended up, they were collecting war veterans benefits from the Mexican government eventually, but most of them were killed off, but they just saw the horrible treatment they were accorded. It was much like the U.S.-Mexican War was much like the Iraq War today. If you were poor or an immigrant, they wanted you to go, but the rich WASP kids didn't go down to that horrible war.
Yeah.
And talking about that, it gets back to the same thing about these camps they want to set up in this country for immigrants, undesirables that they call it. The thing is, we are so dehumanizing towards Arabs and Muslims and Hispanics and Hispanic Americans that we're not at the right country to be doing taking such an approach to this problem, and it is an economic problem. We firstly need to raise the amount of allowed legal immigrants into the country, so that way you can document them. If you're really worried about Al Qaeda, they would have done that years ago, at least.
Well, it's not, Brian, I don't think that we need to raise or not raise the number of legal immigrants you bring in, because the basically it's an economic issue. You want to maintain a certain level of workforce. And this is the big debate that's going on, Brian, and thank you for raising the question. You did a great job of it. And that is that the conservatives understand that labor is just like every other commodity. Or at least this is how the conservatives view it. Labor is just like any other commodity. If you increase its supply, you decrease its price. You flood the market with labor, the price of labor goes down. This is the difference in price and value, right? But that's a whole other discussion. And on the other hand, what the labor movement has understood for the last 150 years that it's existed by and large in the United States is that if you can reduce the supply of labor, you increase its price. And this is one of the reasons why the progressives of the 1905, 1910, it was first knocked down in 1908, 1909 by the Supreme Court. But during Teddy Roosevelt's administration, progressives got a law passed that made child labor illegal. And in large part, it wasn't because they were opposed to the exploitation of children. I mean, they were, and there were a lot of people who were involved in that who thought that it was wrong. But, by and large, they wanted children out of the workforce because it was diluting the workforce and driving down the cost of labor. And so they wanted to control the cost of labor. And so what we have seen is that American history, both on the progressive side and the conservative side, has been this battle to control how much labor there is in the workforce. And ideally, or intelligently, your immigration policy should be, okay, how many people do we need to have in our workforce? How many people do we need in the United States? So that everybody can have a decent job. Well, the conservatives don't want it that way. Conservatives are very happy that there are 11 million illegal immigrants in the United States, because that's 11 million workers competing with the other roughly 100 million workers. That's like 10% of the American workforce, which reduces the value, the cost of American labor by at least 10%. In fact, the estimates that I've seen show that just the construction industry last year showed an extra $1 billion in profit because of wages that they didn't have to pay to unionize labor, but instead we're able to pay to illegal labor. And so that's why I say, this whole illegal immigrant thing it's a red herring. They bring out the racists and they bring out the xenophobes, but really it's all about the money. Fundamentally it's all about the money. And if you simply say, if you hire illegals, you go to jail, then, they're going to leave. They're going to stop coming to this country. Back when we had labor unions, they didn't show up because the unions didn't let them in. 45 minutes past the hour.
is the Tom Hartman Program.
I am a rebel soldier, and far from my home. The grape shot and musket and the cannons lumber loud. It's many a mangled body, the blanket for the shroud. It's many a mangled body left on the fields alone. I am a rebel soldier, and far from my home.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Yeah, the progressive movement, the populist movement, the labor movement, they said, okay, we're going to limit the supply of labor. You can't hire children. So immediately the cost of labor starts going up. You can't make somebody work more than 40 hours a week. So that further tightens the labor market. So the price of labor goes up a little bit higher. You can't make somebody work more than 5 days a week. The price of labor goes up a little higher. And this was all about building a middle class. The whole point of the labor movement was to say, we want a living wage. What Teddy Roosevelt referred to, the living wage. We want a living wage. And, you know, for a lot of years in the United States, from basically the 1930s, when most of these reforms finally were successful, 1937 was the end of the Lochner Court. The Lochner decision in 1905 was the decision where the Supreme Court struck down the 40-hour week for bread bakers in New York and said, no, the Constitution doesn't allow the legislature to pass laws that limit the number of hours somebody can work. And that stood until 1937. And finally, Roosevelt was, you know, able to get the court together to the point where they started affirming progressive laws rather than striking them down. And so from 1937 up until Reagan came along, we had the golden age of the American middle class, and one person working could raise a family, put their kids through school, put their kids through college, pay for all their health care was covered, and retire with a pension. And in part, it was because we controlled the quantity of labor available, which drove up the price of labor, and in part, it was because we had rational trade policies so that American laborers were not competing with laborers in foreign countries on a dollar versus penny basis. A dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes here, 10 cents worth of labor in a pair of shoes there. You put a 90-cent import tariff on it, so it's a dollar no matter where you make it. So, you know, the manufacturers in America were always looking at labor on a level playing field. This is the exact opposite, by the way, of Tom Friedman's preaching with his world is flat. So the conservatives come into power in 1980 with Reagan, and they say, we're going to take this apart. We're going to go back to 1905. We're going to go back to the Gilded Age. We're going to increase the supply of labor and reduce its power. And so they stop enforcing immigration laws. They start busting up unions. Illegal immigration starts to explode in the United States, further increasing the value of labor. Jack Welch is president of GE. He goes over to India and thinking that he's going over there to sell them nuclear power plants, which Bush just did on behalf of General Electric and other companies, presumably Bechtel. And while Jack Welch was over there, the Indians sold him on the idea of outsourcing some of his white-collar work, and General Electric led the charge for that, began the big outsourcing of America. Now we find 89%, this is from bignewsnetwork.com, 89% of U.S., British, and Asian corporate technology decision-makers plan to increase their outsourcing budget over the next 12 months. Survey conducted at the Patani Computer Systems Annual Conference, Patani Connect, found that 39% said they expect to increase outsourcing spending by up to 20% over current spending, while 11% plan for a 50% or more increase. So it's all about reducing the cost of labor. Well, what happens when you reduce the cost of labor? Two things happen. The first is that corporations become more profitable. They become massively more profitable. The CEO pay goes from a 30-to-1 ratio of CEO to the lowest paid employee in the company to 500-to-1. Here we are. just like we were in 1929. The second thing that happens is that the middle class begins to vanish and is replaced by the working poor. People are having to work 40, 50, 60, 70 hours, or two people have to work a combination of 80, 90, or 100 hours a week to maintain a household that in 1979 you could have maintained with one person working 40 hours a week at the same standard of living. And so the consequence of this is, you know, the destruction of the middle class, which means that as the middle class goes away, people don't have the leisure time to pay attention to the news. They don't have the leisure time to get active in politics. They don't even have the inclination. They're struggling so hard just to make a living, just to get by, and they become vulnerable to the demagogues in our society. They become more vulnerable to the people in our society who say, oh, well, the fault, I know that you're experiencing terrible times right now, and you know what's going to solve the problem? If we just get rid of abortion. Or if we just make a flag-burning amendment. Or if we just get rid of all those liberals. It's those liberals. They're the ones that cause it. And the demagogues go on their rants. And the conservatives are sitting back going, look at that. All these Americans, they think the Republicans are working for them. And they think the conservative Democrats are working for them. They're sadly mistaken. And they're laughing all the way to the bank. And the reality is now, with the social safety net as badly frayed as it is, that unlike 30 years ago, the middle class, we are all the working poor now, because everybody in the American middle class, all of us, by and large, are just a few paychecks or a major illness away from absolute economic devastation. It need not be this way, my friends, and if we get politically active, we can change it. Coming up in the next Tom Hartman program, the Frame Shop is open with Jeffrey Feldman. The frame is rape, with rape on the rise. The South Dakota governor signs a bill banning abortion. Is the New York Times questioning PTSD veterans getting the help they need? That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Remember, tag your it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.